This episode is brought to you by Bombas. The kids are back in school, vacations are over, and it's officially the start of cozy season, which means time to slide into some Bombas. You know Bombas, the most comfortable socks, slippers, tees, and underwear that are out there, made from premium materials that actually make sense for this time of year. Listen, my wife and I are huge fans of Bombas. I have probably a dozen pairs. They are my favorite socks. Actually, when I'm out of Bombas socks in my wash cycle, I get a little depressed, but it's a good motivation for me to get my wash done, which is something I don't like to do. And this season, Bombas has the softest materials. Think merino wool. It keeps you warm when it's chilly out, but cool when it's hot. Supima cotton, that's softer, stronger, and more breathable than regular cotton. And even rag wool, the thick, durable, classic cozy sock that you'll want all fall. And the best part, Bombas has a great mission. For every item you buy, Bombas donates one to someone experiencing homelessness. Over 150 million items have been donated thanks to customers. And Bombas has a happiness guarantee. If you're not 100% into what you got, they'll make it right. No risk, all reward. Head over to bombas.com/curb and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/curb and use the code CURB at checkout.
The Curb Sliders Podcast is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of those and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible for this. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're ready.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Well, wait.
Yeah, Stuart, we're starting. We are officially recording. You are on air. And how's it going, buddy?
It's okay.
I don't want to delve into that. I'm just going to blow by it. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for asking.
I've got some great friends.
Yeah. The sadder Stuart is, the happier I am. So I feel like this is going to be an excellent night for me.
And with us is the Chew Man.
Hey, what's up?
Chris, thanks. You're going to be kind of running the show here tonight. This is our second Journal Club episode. This is for May 2018 with some recent articles that we'll be going through. And I'll kind of let you take it from here, Chris. If you want to remind people, since we probably have a lot of new people joining, if you want to just kind of lay out what the format is of this kind of show.
Today is our monthly edition of the Curbsider Journal Club, where we bring you the news that we find most interesting. This list that we have that we're going to talk about was culled here by the Curbsider team, as well as some of our listeners that gave us great suggestions on Facebook and Twitter. The first part of the show includes our main review. We call these our hotcakes. Basically, we want to bring this knowledge food to your brain hole.
Of course we
and,
do. Just to be 100% clear, I did not sign off on this whole hotcake thing. I'm just putting that out there publicly.
And we'll have 1 to 3 reviews. This time we do have 3. We'll do sort of a pseudo deep dive on the subject and sort of give our, whether we feel this is practice changing or not. The second part of the episode will sort of be just sort of some really hot takes on some of the more interesting news articles and journals that we found from the month. So the theme of our hotcakes or our main reviews today is hypertension, because that's something all of us internists really like to talk about. So the first one, I think Matt's going to talk about ambulatory monitoring.
Right. Yeah. This was from April 2018, New England Journal of Medicine. The author was Benegas et al. And this is data from a Spanish ambulatory blood pressure registry. I thought it was a really interesting article. They looked at, so first of all, there was around 64,000 patients, mean age of 58 years old. 40% of the patients in this trial, at least at the start of the trial, were not on blood pressure meds, and they followed them for a median of 4.7 years. And during the trial, there was about 6% death rate, so about 3,800 people died during the trial, 1,300 of which was from cardiovascular cause. And they looked at clinic blood pressure. So clinic blood pressure was elevated if it was higher than 140/90, and also ambulatory blood pressure. So ambulatory blood pressure elevated if it was higher than 130/80. And just to define the terms here, white coat hypertension was if the clinic blood pressure was higher than 140 over 90, but when they did the ambulatory study, it was less than 130 over 80. Masked hypertension was the opposite of that. So it was not elevated in clinic, but at home, their blood pressure was higher than 130 over 80. And then sustained hypertension is just, they were just hypertensive everywhere. And it sounds like they did actually do a decent job measuring the clinic blood pressure. The patients were resting for 5 minutes. They took at least two, and then they took the average of those two readings. And they basically found that blood pressure medications work. So patients who were on blood pressure medicine in this trial had lower mortality in general, even if their blood pressure was not quote unquote controlled, meaning like if their blood pressure in clinic was still higher than 140 over 90, as long as they were on a blood pressure medicine, it still had a mortality benefit. So what I was surprised at from this was that white coat hypertension, white coat hypertension actually had a increased mortality risk. The hazard ratio was about 1.8. Now, if that patient was on a blood pressure medicine, it was no longer significant. But to me, your patients with white coat hypertension, it had not been my practice to treat patients with white coat hypertension, but this study is suggesting that you should, because when you put those patients on meds, that mortality increase that they saw went away. And masked hypertension is where they actually saw the highest increase in mortality, which was dampened a little bit by that patient being on a blood pressure medicine. Paul, Stuart, Chris, anything that you guys that struck you about this trial?
You know, the whole thing about the masked hypertension to me makes the most sense, because if the time in your life is when you're the least stressed out is when you're going to go see the doctor, that suggests you have an incredibly stressful life. So to me, that's completely makes sense to me.
Yeah. And for me, I feel like we've known for years that masked hypertension confers higher risk. Like, I don't think that's a surprise. For me, it was nice to see actually some risk, not nice, but I'm glad to see that there's some risk attributable to white coat hypertension, which I was never quite sure what to do with before. And I don't think anyone was. We kind of were like, it's probably okay. Maybe it's all right. But I mean, to me, it makes sense. If you have such a low reserve for stress that coming to the doctor's office causes your blood pressure to shoot up, then probably that's going to happen throughout life. So my suspicion is,
yeah,
maybe that's the physiology behind it. Body of knowledge.
I always looked at white coat hypertension as more of a reactive hypertension. So you probably react pretty aggressively to stress. So if you have a relatively stressless life and you overreact to stress, that suggests that you probably need to have a blunted response to that stress. So either through some type of like CBT, maybe even a beta blocker. That's the way that I approach it personally, but I don't even know if that's evidence-based.
Go ahead and say no.
Yeah, I didn't see any specific recommendations for what to do about these results. But I think definitely you should consider treating patients, especially if they're kind of on the borderline. If they have white coat hypertension, this suggests a mortality benefit by treating it.
And it didn't matter which med that they used?
They really looked at just like, was a person on blood pressure med at the start of the study? Right. They didn't kind of follow like, were meds added throughout the course of the study? So it was sort of just like the initial clinic blood pressure reading, the initial 24-hour study, and then they followed them out for mortality. So I don't have all those specifics.
That's right. That wasn't a gotcha question. That was more of a trying to figure it out. I promise you, it wasn't a gotcha question.
That's okay.
All right. So in the end, does this change any of our practices? I mean, what are our takeaway points from this?
Yeah, I think it does. I think you have to take white coat hypertension seriously, and you should certainly have the suspicion for masked hypertension. So if you see a patient that has LVH, you know, you should investigate there. Like if their blood pressure is not high in clinic, but you're seeing LVH on their EKG that you got for some who knows what reason, then I think you have to pursue that.
Stuart, how many hotcakes do you give this?
How many do I give it? I think we have to toss that one over to Matt.
I'd give this at least a medium stack of hotcakes with butter and syrup. Is that a thing?
Yes.
Might lower your blood pressure.
All right. Let's move on to the next one.
Yeah. So, Stuart, I think you got the next one about blood pressure treatment strategies based on cardiovascular risks versus just regular blood pressure monitoring.
Yeah. So this one's a recently published article from March of this year, is published in I never know what to call this. Where do you call it? PLOS medicine?
I think so.
Yeah. So it's an interesting article. I don't think it's really practice changing. It looks at treating blood pressure under two different strategies, either looking at the systolic blood pressure or looking at an internally validated model, a Weibull model. So it's a multivariate analysis model. And then establishing whether or not they would reduce the number of events avoided higher with the standard blood pressure, the systolic blood pressure, or the Weibull multivariate analysis model. So it's kind of a fancy way of saying they compared the CVD risk to standard blood pressure. And for the most part, so when we look at a blood pressure target of 140, it wasn't really statistically significant to look at the CVD risk, but anything over that suggested that if you went through, if you applied their CVD risk calculator or their CVD risk model, would have treated less patients to obtain the same number of avoided major adverse cardiac events. So that's essentially what it boils down to. The problems that I have with the study is, number one, I don't even know what model they're using or how they're applying the model. And when they applied the Framingham risk calculator, the one that I typically use in clinic, it wasn't as impressive. So I'm not really sure how this would even apply to my practice, how I would use this Weibull multivariate model in my practice. I just don't understand. Maybe I'm missing something here. Someone help me.
Now, Stuart, I have a question. How is this now? So they're looking at using cardiovascular risk estimation and then trying to decide like how to control someone's blood pressure. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with the new ACC/AHA guidelines, you know, aren't we sort of doing something like that? At least trying to decide in the middle area?
Yeah, exactly. We've kind of pushed the goalpost a little bit, I guess, closer up. So when we look at patients with a higher CVD risk, we're actually targeting a lower blood pressure than was looked at in this study. So instead of the 140, we're looking at 130. So I don't think there's nothing in here that would change my practice whatsoever.
But I do think what's happening that we're seeing, and we talked about this on our diabetes episode, that basically I think what treatment's going to look like more in the future is, instead of just looking at like one number, like blood pressure higher than 140 over 90, we're going to look at a risk score that takes into account multiple factors, which probably does a better job of predicting risk. And then we can sort of, we'll look at agents that are known to lower that risk. And I think, you know, we have that with cholesterol. We might be moving in that direction with diabetes and maybe with blood pressure too, because while patients like these numbers, because it's like, you know, it's a very like finite, this is your number. I feel like it's just one variable, whereas this risk score had, you know, had like a bunch of different variables like smoking and diabetes, history of cardiovascular disease, their BMI, and all these other factors. And mm-hmm. they found it was almost like a more efficient way to treat, where you treated less patients, but you prevented more cardiovascular disease by this model.
Right. So so when you compared it to a systolic blood pressure of like 150, when you compared it to the 140, it was less impressive.
Exactly.
In fact, it did not approach statistical significance.
And the subgroup.
So I think when you look at a lower blood pressure target, this right now doesn't pan out. Now, ultimately we'll be able to find out what this, you know, wonderful magic bullet calculator is that you're talking about, but we're not there. This Weibull model is not it. So that's kind of my take home point here. We are not quite there.
I agree. I think it's aspirational, Stuart.
It certainly is. Certainly is. I'd like some more aspiration.
I think it depends on how dogmatic about guidelines you want to be, too. So, yeah, the Weibull calculators maybe not be the solution, but I agree with Matt that this is, again, more towards a risk-based, individualized approach than just I'm going for this target because that's an easy number to remember. Like, I think this is, I guess, more ammunition for more patient-centered care as opposed to just absolutism based on measurements, because I don't think that's an appropriate way to treat blood pressure.
Yeah, I certainly.
So how many hotcakes, Stuart? That's the question.
Yeah.
Do you give this even a short stack?
Right. I'll give it a drive-through.
Drive-through hotcake?
Yeah, whatever that is.
All right. Let's move on to the next one then. Paul, I think you got one that we're discussing, the association of repeated measurements of blood pressure in the primary care setting.
Sure. How long was that article?
So I took the easy way out, just chose the absolute shortest article I could go through. And
good for you.
One that satisfies my my confirmation bias rather than, you know, actually having to read a lot of statistics. So this worked out great for me. But I looked at the Association of Repeated Measurements with Blood Pressure Control in Primary Care. It is a glorious two-page research letter to be found in JAMA Internal Medicine.
I like how the preview is one page. It's like literally half of the article.
Yeah, I think Journal Watch, the summary actually was longer than the article itself, if I'm not mistaken. But basically, so what these folks did is they set a best practice advisory into the electronic health record. They set up this alert that would go off. So if the initial blood pressure is greater than 140 over 90, it was supposed to alert the practitioner to repeat the blood pressure in the office. And then theoretically, they did that. And so they looked at 38,260 patients that made 80,864 primary care visits. And at over 30,000 visits, the initial blood pressure is greater than 140 over 90. And so that prompted a repeat. And basically, the long and the short of it is what they found is that the repeat measurement was significantly lower than the initial measurement. And so as I think the mean, if I'm not mistaken, was somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 millimeters systolic, the repeat measurement being lower than the initial measurement, which, again, this article appealed to me because this is consistent with sort of my own practice where I feel like people are kind of hustled into triage and maybe the blood pressure is not taken exactly according to Hoyle. And then maybe I do a little bit, I'm trying to think of a diplomatic way to say this.
Chewing.
Yes, yes. I talk with my sweet, sweet baritone and calm the patients down, and they're sitting there, and I don't let them talk to me when I'm measuring it because it's a chance for a sweet silence. And so maybe I get a little bit lower pressure reading that way. So it's consistent with my own practice. So like I said, this sort of confirms a bias that I already sort of had. They do mention that this effect is even accounting for regression to the mean. So you would expect that a repeat blood pressure measurement would be closer to the number that you want in any case, but this actually is more than that. So in terms of whether or not this would change my practice, no is the short answer. And then in terms, it's, like I said, it's two pages. I don't know if I mentioned that this article is two pages. So they didn't really delve into.
You just want to read it verbatim?
How consistently that they actually followed through and repeated the blood pressure measurement. I suspect they're, in my own practice, I feel like there's a little bit of confirmation bias. Like I'll get a blood pressure reading that I like and then stop checking. You know what I mean? Like if it's higher, then I'll just keep checking it until it's a number I like, which is probably not the best way to do it. And I don't know if there's any way to make sure that didn't happen in these particular circumstances.
Now, Paul, I have a question. So, you know, the recent SPRINT trial, which, you know, a lot of our blood pressure guidelines seem to be based off nowadays, you know, they had repeated multiple blood pressure readings and did the average, right? So, and in which way, how does that relate to the discussion here on this, with this article?
I don't think I understand your question.
No. Oh. Hmm. Well, so with the SPRINT trial, I mean, they took multiple measurements and did the average of those blood pressure ratings, didn't they? And so they, you know, basically a lot of our guidelines are based on repeated blood pressure measurements now. So it seems reasonable that, you know, this is probably what's going to start happening. Hopefully this is what's going to be standard of care.
Sure. Except in this case, they only did it for hypertensive patients. So I'm not sure.
Yeah.
There's
someone could have come in with a normal blood
too.
Pressure so, and then checked it twice and it would have been higher.
Right. So if you account for regression to the mean and you choose a hypertensive population, probably by definition, most of those patients are going to have elevated blood pressure, at least initially. Well, except unless you're good at treating blood pressure, which apparently I'm not, which I'm disclosing now. And then you would expect the second to be a little bit lower. So I feel like there's no surprise here. So for me, I would give this, not that you asked, I would give this one delicious hotcake because I think it's interesting. I think it's kind of valid, but it leads me wanting like a lot more. I feel like it's, I don't know if I mentioned this at the outset, but this is two pages long. And so I would like to actually know how consistently this was done, how often they repeated the measurements, for whom. I didn't get a sense of the internal quality control with this particular study. And I think just by dint of, they didn't have space for it.
I think they said actually like 36% of the patients in this study had a repeat blood pressure if it was high on the initial time.
Yeah, I think that's right.
And so we mentioned regression to the mean a whole bunch of times. So I feel like we should just kind of mention. So regression to the mean just sort of talks about patients in general, patients that get enrolled in studies tend to be sort of outliers that have like numbers that are far outside the normal range. And just sort of by chance, if you keep checking blood pressures, those people are going to tend to drift back towards the kind of average.
Right.
It, you know, and that's what regression to the mean is. So that's what they're saying here. Like, if you happen to check a blood pressure and the first one's high, chances are if you keep checking, it's going to kind of come back towards a more normal range, or what is the average range. So, yeah, Paul,
so what do you think?
How many hotcakes, one hotcake out of how many? Like, how many hotcakes come in a stack? I think we should figure this out.
75.
Six?
Six? Okay.
I want to go on the record again. Six. I really feel this is a flawed rating system.
So I think a short stack is three hotcakes, and and a full stack is six hotcakes. Chris, can we agree on that?
I agree.
Okay.
I thought it was going to be like, whose line is it anyways?
All right.
Many points.
I think we beat this to death now. Let's. So,
darn it, I had a question.
What?
Oh,
a question?
No, no. It was kind of just a. By the way, what do you think blood pressure checking is going to look like in 10 years in practice? Like, where do you think
it's going to look like? Sprint trial.
You think so?
Yeah. So I've been recently looking into getting new blood pressure monitors for our clinic, and this really expensive blood pressure monitor from a manufacturer I'm not going to mention basically does exactly what the sprint trial does. You can put it on sprint trial mode. You put the cuff on the patient. You have them lay their hand on top of the machine. You leave the room. It'll automatically take the blood pressure several times, average it, and automatically upload it to our EMR system. And it's super expensive.
Flash some pictures of the Sistine sort of Chapel. What, play some Tchaikovsky in the background.
Chris did a cost benefit analysis, and like, we're going to save office visits and we're going to save money on blood pressure, you know, treatment and all that stuff, right, Chris?
Actually, that's my QI project, because I'm the one arm with the automatic cuff, while another colleague of mine is just using a rolling blood pressure cuff, and we're going to look at our metrics in a couple of months and see how, if at least we can show that I've got better metrics than him without actually changing any of our practice.
Oh,
all right,
wrap
so.
It up.
It's time to wrap it up. Sarah says that we're taking too long. All right. Now that we've discussed our main articles for today, we do have a list of a bunch of other articles and news that came out recently that we did find interesting. We're not going to talk about all of them on the episode today, but we did pull out a couple quick hot takes that we want to talk about. These are sort of meant to be nugget-sized and to give our listeners an idea of what's going on in the recent literature. So we have a group of categories of some guideline updates. The first one is from USPSTF about prostate cancer. Do you want to talk about that, Stuart?
Sure, if I'm forced to. So, especially with my patients, if I have to and if I'm forced to. Oh, you like that one.
I actually like that, Stuart. That's good.
Great, great. Yeah, so I think that the biggest thing that I liked about the USPSTF recommendations is actually not what USPSTF said, but what Vinay Prasad said on Twitter. I think it's hilarious. So if you just read through his tweets on PSA screening, there's actually one graph that he pulled out. I tried to find which article it was from, but it actually showed that all-cause mortality was actually higher in the group that received screening versus the group that it did not receive screening. To the two, I mean, it's a very small number. So all-cause mortality was like 0.25 per 1,000 men in a 10-year follow-up, so incredibly low. So, and also not statistically significant of a P that literally was 0.49. So literally, no difference. But there is no improvement in mortality either.
Yeah, I highly encourage our listeners to check out this tweetorial from Vinay Prasad. It's actually really fun to go through, and it's an interesting new way to sort of use the media.
Yeah. So just to go through add a little bit to this. In 2012, there was a D rating, which is pretty much do not screen for PSA. Mm-hmm. But now it was upgraded to a C rating, and that's why this was a news story. PSA screening for men ages 55 to 69 years old, there may be a small net benefit. And this is mostly based on the ER-SPC trial, which is one of the two. It was a European trial, large trial, for prostate screening, and it prevented 1.3 deaths per 1,000 men screened if you followed them for 13 years. And I think like at 10 years, there was no difference or no mortality benefit, but then it sort of eked up over that next 3 years. So they also said that you might, if you screen 1,000 men, you might prevent 3 cases of metastatic prostate cancer. I will remind people so false positives, you know, can cause psychological harm. There's need for biopsy. You can also get overdiagnosis and treatment by screening. And the numbers for treatment, if a man has a radical prostatectomy, there's a 2 in 3 will have, 2 in 3 will have erectile dysfunction, and 1 in 5 will have urinary incontinence.
You know, one of the things that I should have looked up before this this episode, there was an article that I'd recently read. I know I should have pulled this one up, that looked at the incidence of depression with a diagnosis of prostate cancer and showed a significant positive correlation. And the thought process was actually just that with a diagnosis of prostate cancer, thinking that your life was going to end soon, that depression went up, but so did suicide attempts and ideation.
All right. We're going to move on. Our next guideline update was also from USPSTF about intimate partner violence guidance or violence. And it's sort of Paul, you want to talk about that?
Sure. It's that it exists is kind of the exciting thing. Yeah. So there's the USPSTF recommendation for intimate partner violence screening is that it recommends that clinicians screen for intimate partner violence in women of reproductive age. And then should they screen positive, provide a referral woman who screen positive to ongoing support services. Things to bear in mind is that they don't really specify a screening frequency. They don't specify which specific screening tools to use. They do note that the screening tools tend to be effective. There's HITS, which most people have heard of. There's also the HARCS tool. The HARC tool, I should say. But there's a number of tools that can be used for screening. They don't make a specific recommendation. And then an interesting sort of second recommendation or sort of non-recommendation for older or vulnerable adults is that the USPSTF concluded that the current evidence is insufficient to assess the balance of benefits and harms of screening for abuse and neglect in all older or vulnerable adults. So those who are physically or mentally, quote, dysfunctional, end quote. So they don't have enough evidence to actually comment on whether it's not of benefit to screen that particular patient population.
That just seems odd.
I agree.
That just seems incredibly odd. I've had several patients who I've had to refer for elder abuse.
Now, Paul, these aren't like final recommendations yet either, right? These are still in.
Correct.
These are still the draft, correct?
That's exactly right. These are still the draft phase.
I would just recommend just thinking ahead to listeners. If you are going to screen for intimate partner violence, before you start doing that, you should have some sort of a plan in case you get a positive screen. So talk to your social worker before you do that. And I think we should move on.
Sounds good.
All right. So we do look at some of the news that are in the lay media. One of the big ones that came out in the last month is that basically people said alcohol is slowly killing you. Now, Stuart, you want to talk a little bit more about this one?
I think that was Matt's.
Oh, Matt, did you want to talk about this?
Yeah. So this was from April 2018 from The Lancet. The head author was Angela Wood. And this was looking at almost 600,000 patients from 83 prospective studies. Oh, no. And what I thought was interesting here is that in the UK, both men and women can have 8 drinks per week. That's their recommendation. But in the US, for some reason, we only give women can only have 7 drinks per week and men can have twice that. So I just, you know, that was interesting, you know, not sure what that's about. But basically what this was looking at is all-cause mortality. Anyone who was consuming more than 100 grams of alcohol per week, which is about 7 drinks, would have an increase in mortality. And so at age 40 years old, if you're having more than 100 grams per week, they predict that's about a 6-month decrease in your life expectancy.
Wow.
If you're having more than 200 grams per week, that's a 1 to 2 year decrease in life expectancy. And if you're having a whopping 350 grams, which by my calculations is roughly 24 drinks, so a case of beer a week, then that's a 4 to 5 year decrease in life expectancy. And the younger you are, the bigger decrease in life expectancy. So
100 grams, I just did the calculation, unless I'm completely wrong, that's less than a 6-pack a week.
It's 14 grams per drink, I think, something like that.
Well, so 5% alcohol, so it's 5% times 355 ml, it's 17.75 grams, 100 divided by 17.75 is 5.6 drinks per week.
Yeah, so don't drink a drink every day. And yeah, the other thing is there was a study earlier this year that we can also link to that cognitive decline seems to be, even for moderate drinkers, cognitive decline seems to be more prevalent when you follow them out. So,
all right, time to move on. Sarah's telling me that we need to move on. Uh-oh. So we have a couple articles talking about DPP-4s. I think this is an interesting one for most of us. I think, Stuart, you had some interesting comments on this one.
Yeah, I mean, this is great because... So this is an article from I'm sorry, I'm throwing off here by reading some of these texts. So this is from JAMA. So this is it's looking at GLP-1 receptor agonists, the DPP-4 inhibitors, and the SGLT-2 inhibitors. All right, cards on the table. I love my GLP-1 receptor agonists, and I love my SGLT-2 inhibitors. I do not necessarily like my DPP-4 inhibitors, and this kind of confirms my concerns. So the DPP-4 inhibitors does not tend towards improvement in any kind of mortality. When you look at SGLP-1 receptor agonists and the SGLT-2 inhibitors, on the other hand, we have a lot of data that actually suggests that there is a mortality benefit with these medications. And I wish we were able to look at these medications as formulary choices for a lot of our patients, because unfortunately I don't know about you guys, but I've got to jump through several hoops just to get SGLT2 inhibitor approved. A GLP-1 receptor agonist is also very difficult. But when you look at the actual cost, say like for the metformin sitagliptin combination, that's very expensive and is on par with some of the GLP-1 receptor agonists. So I don't understand why, at least with some of the formularies that I work with, that these are considered to be more of a first line medication when compared to the SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists. My gosh, that's a lot of.
I really do think these formulas are going to change now that once people read these trials and becomes more accepted.
Yeah.
Now, do we want to talk about the second DPP-4 article?
Matt? Yeah, I just wanted to point out that the meta-analysis Stuart was referencing, they looked at both SGLT2 and GLP-1 versus control, which could be, you know, a placebo or just kind of standard therapy, or versus the DPP-4 head to head.
And so that was the association between SGLT2 inhibitors, GLP-1 receptor agonists, DPP-4 inhibitors with all cause mortality in patients with type 2 diabetes, published in JAMA, April 17th, 2018. Bam.
Okay. All right. We'll move on. Okay. The other thing that I wanted to just mention about DPP-4 is I believe this was from the BMJ. And this study, I'll tell you, it's not going to be practice changing. I just thought it was interesting. The background here is that low levels of DPP-4 enzyme, which is kind of ubiquitous, it's not just involved in diabetes or the GLP-1 metabolism, but basically low DPP-4 enzyme has been associated with increased IBD activity. So they looked at this like set of 141,000 patients over 18 years old with diabetes, some of whom had been exposed to DPP-4 inhibitors, and they found that there was actually an increased risk of IBD events. I will say that over 552,000 patient years of follow-up, there was only 208 IBD events. And, you know,
that's crazy.
So to me, this was not really practice changing. It was just interesting. I didn't know about the association of the low enzymes and IBD.
What I loved about this is that it was published in the BM Journal.
All right. Now on to a couple articles about life and medicine. The first one is an article that I actually recently learned about during a Grand Rounds talk that I went to about the association between teaching status and mortality in U.S. hospitals. I think, Stuart, you read a little bit more about this?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if I read much more than you guys, aside from just scanning a little bit closer. So what I liked about this one is that it kind of confirmed what my innate biases is, that is that mortality at a large teaching center tends towards lower mortality than those at a non-teaching facility. And this actually looked at, I mean, the amount of data that they looked through is just insane. 21 million total hospitalizations involving 4,483 hospitals. That is just bonkers, to use Paul's words there. That's all I had to say.
I think you were saying, you also want to talk a little bit about seasonality. Was there something about that?
Yeah, actually, that was something we were talking about on the pre-recording. That I'm not aware. So I went through the study as quickly as I could before we started recording again for a second time, and I didn't see anything about any seasonal variation. I am a little concerned about some of the seasonal variation at some of these teaching centers, as you have new trainees that onboard around the June, July timeframe. I think we've always had this kind of concern that some of these untrained trainees may be contributing, but there's nothing there that even suggests that. But of course, these are also concerns that you could have at non-teaching facilities too, when you have a new grad who's in processing, so to speak.
Agreed. All right, so the last article from our hot takes category is 5 lifestyle factors that could add more than 10 years to life expectancy. This is from Circulation.
I like number 4.
So the 5 things are: number 1 is healthy diet, number 2 is never smoking, number 3 is moderate to vigorous physical activity at least 30 minutes per day, number 4 is moderate alcohol consumption,
that makes
and
no
number
sense.
5 is healthy BMI. So I don't know, did you guys read it? Did you guys look at this article any deeper than this?
Not really. I just think that everyone should strive to have those 5. Probably drinking in moderation. I'd be interested how they define that. If it was 100 grams a week or was it less?
Chris, how did they define that? Do you know?
Actually, I have to go back and look.
While you're doing that, Chris, I wanted to bring up the NT-proBNP monitoring in patients admitted with acute decompensated heart failure. I was sad that this appears to not work. You know, I had heard some people do this for their practice where they basically admit a patient, check a baseline NT-proBNP, diurese the heck out of the patient, and then kind of once it gets back to their quote baseline, almost like we do with a dry weight, they discharge the patient. And it turns out that did not have any sort of benefit for mortality or rehospitalization. And they looked out to 6 months. So sad to see that one did not work.
Now, isn't that one of the new recommendations though for systolic heart failure? I thought that we covered this. I thought
like
that was
at
actually
discharge.
No, I think it's really, I think the recommendation there, and I'd have to go back and look, was it just to check it because it shows that there is a high risk of mortality in patients where that's elevated. And actually, there was another article looking at just BNP over BNP, not NT-proBNP, but any elevation in any patient was associated with increased mortality, even right. if the patient didn't have heart failure.
Now, this was to look at NT-proBNP guided therapy during hospitalization. Right. So, and we know that there's several conditions that certainly cause a lower than normal NT-proBNP that could affect. You know, I think this suggests that at least for clinically decompensated heart failure, you have to follow them clinically, not necessarily follow their NT-proBNP. I don't think that's practice changing. Did it say anything about checking either a BNP or a proBNP at discharge and following that?
That you mean like after discharge? Like no, they just followed. What they did was they checked a baseline in the hospitalization, uh-huh. and once it had decreased by at least 30%,
yeah.
and they were clinically stable, then they would consider that the endpoint versus conventional therapy, which is just, you know, you treat their heart failure when the patient's feeling better, looking better, you discharge.
Right. Okay.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted our time for our hot takes. As you can imagine, there's still tons of other interesting things that we have read over the last month. You can see the full list of these in our and links to their discussions in our show notes. And then lastly, I want to plug a podcast that I just recently listened to on history of medicine called Bedside Rounds. And I think everyone should check that out if they enjoy the history of medicine.
Yeah, and I should probably apologize for a tweet error where I tried to tweet that this is worth a listen, and I think I wrote this is worse a listen. But sorry about that, Adam. Your podcast is great.
That's right. That's Adam Rodman. So no, really, if you guys like podcasts like Hardcore History and things like that, but really want to learn about medicine, it's a great podcast to check out. So I want to thank all the listeners who reached out to us on Twitter and Facebook for the suggestions for the articles to include in this month's edition of Hot Cakes and Hot Takes. If you're a listener, like the med students over at University of Queensland, Ushner, or have something interesting you want us to discuss, please send it our way. You guys have any other things you want to add before we wrap up?
Just that this has been another episode of the Curbsiders, bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Yay.
You can find show notes at thecurbsiders.com/podcast or get on our mailing list at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood. You can Yummy. Reach out to us at thecurbsiders@gmail.com or on Facebook, Instagram, or on Twitter at thecurbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
Chris.
Oh, I'm Christopher Chu.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham. And good night.
And I remain Dr. Paul Nelson Williams, and goodbye.
And before we go, I'd like to thank our producer, Sarah Phoebe Roberts. Sarah, I hope you're okay with me saying your middle name. And also our social media team, Beth Garbatelli on Instagram, Hannah Abrams on Twitter, and Chris Chumanchu still on Facebook.
That's me.
All right.